All right, open your Bibles to Genesis chapter 32. Where we left off, Jacob had spent 20 years in Paddan Aram. And, of course, his 20 years started off with him wanting to marry Rachel. He was told he would have to work 7 years for her. Had the wedding night, woke up the next day, and they had actually married Leah off to him. Because, according to his uncle Laban, it was not the custom in that area for the youngest to get married before the oldest. He didn't bother to tell Jacob that. So Jacob had to work another 7 years for Rachel to marry her, so that's a total of 14. And then they started having lots and lots of kids. There was sort of a race between Leah and Rachel. Leah took the lead 6-1, and the handmaidens also gave birth to what would become the future tribes of Israel. So right now we've got 11 kids, and Jacob, of course, we won't go into all the wealth gathering he did, but he's got lots of flocks that God blessed him with in some mysterious way, dealing with the color of these reeds that he planted by the water. And so he acquired much of Laban's flocks. And he just got to the point where he said, it's time for me to go home. And he was told when he left, he was to go there, get a wife, and come back. I don't know, ladies, if you've ever had your husband go to the store and he comes back 4 hours later instead of 30 minutes. Imagine 20 years. All right, he's been gone for 20 years. So he's heading back to his homeland, and Laban starts pursuing him. And when Laban encounters him, Laban says, you know, you're taking my daughters, you're taking my sons, and he's speaking of his grandsons, and you're taking all my flocks. Laban's sons were upset because they felt that Jacob had ripped off their inheritance, and that just wasn't true. Jacob worked for the entire thing, but they eventually meet, and it looks like things might go bad, except that the Lord had talked to Laban the night before and said, don't say anything good or bad to Jacob. And literally in the Hebrew it means from good to bad. In other words, you can't say anything bad, you can't threaten him, you can't do any of the things that Laban set out to do, because it looked like he was setting out to maybe kill Jacob and take all of this stuff back. Well, they eventually make a covenant, and that's the way chapter 31 closes out. Now we're in chapter 32, and there's some really fascinating things here. So let's take a look, and I want you to see this very first verse. Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. Now that's interesting. You may not have known, but the angels of God actually traveled with Jacob on this trip. Jacob said when he saw them, this is God's camp. So he named the place Mahanaim, which means two camps. So we've got the angel camps, we've got Laban's camp back behind it, but these angels are actually there traveling with Jacob the rest of the way. And yet he doesn't take advantage of that in the sense that it hits him spiritually. Oh, I'm actually being taken care of. And you know, I believe when we look at Scripture that we have angels with us as well. I've experienced that presence without seeing them, but there are just some things that have happened to me in my life that cannot be explained. Like the time I got shot at outside of Tonopah, Arizona. And I was about 10 feet from a 9mm handgun when the crazy methed out guy started shooting, and not one bullet hit me. Now, I didn't have holes or anything in my clothes. Maybe it was just a bad shot. But even the worst shot went on to be able to hit something from 10 feet away. But how do you explain? God certainly intervened. Well, God was intervening in Jacob's life with his angelic beings, and I believe they are with us today. In fact, in the book of Hebrews, it says, beware lest you entertain angels unaware. We don't know really what goes on in that supernatural, spiritual realm, world. But angels do exist, just like God really exists as well. And typically, whenever we see them, they take human form. Like if you look in the book of Daniel, you'll see the angel Gabriel. And you'll see other angels throughout Scripture. But Gabriel made an appearance to Daniel. And these angels, several of them, are making an appearance. Now, what I find interesting about them is we don't know how big they are or how many they are, but they have a camp. We do know that one angel protected Jerusalem against the armies of Sennacherib and Rabshakeh and killed, 185,000 of them in one night. That's one angel. Pretty amazing. So you really don't want to mess with those who the Lord sends. Anyway, now Jacob is heading home. Who is he expecting that he's probably going to encounter?
Esau.
And what was Esau's plan 20 years ago? To kill him because he believed that Jacob stole his inheritance. And Jacob really didn't. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. Now, this is important because he's got angels with him, but Jacob is still trying to do things his own way. He wants to solve this problem in the flesh, so he comes up with a plan on how to encounter Esau as opposed to just relying on the angelic beings that are walking with him. He also commanded them in verse 4, saying, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I might find favor in your sight." So he's setting up Esau, letting him know he has a whole bunch of stuff. He hasn't come back for the purpose of taking any of Esau's stuff. And Esau was very, very wealthy at this time as well. But there'll be more to this. The messengers returned to Jacob saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." Does that sound like a good sign or a bad sign? Probably a bad sign. 400 men are coming with him. That's like an army. And while Jacob has a few servants, he doesn't have 400 men to do battle for him. So these messengers probably were not real successful in talking with Esau. Verse 7, "Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies." Now, should he be distressed? He's got the angels. He was told to go there. God would be with him and bring him back. God is going to be with him, and he still is operating in the flesh. He still has that fear. When God tells us to do something, he will prepare us for it, he will equip us for it, and he will protect us through whatever it is he wants us to do. When he says, "Get in the boat, let's go to the other side," where are you going to end up? On the other side, right? Even if that storm comes up, you're going to the other side. Even if Jesus is asleep in your boat, he said, "Go to the other side. We're going to the other side." You don't have to worry, you don't have to fret. And you know, I see too much of that going on in light of this coronavirus right now. God is still in charge. He's still with each and every one of us, and he can protect us. But we see this mass fear. And you know, I've got a philosophy that has served me very well over the years. Don't panic now. There's always time to panic later. And that's really true. You need a level head when you're going through these types of things so you can think them through. You don't need to panic about it because we are in God's hands and each one of us has our days numbered. Do we not? We're not going to die too soon and we're not going to die too late. We're going to go to be with the Lord should he tarry in death, or we're going to go to be with the Lord when he calls us up into the clouds. We're going to be just fine. Anyway, where am I at? Flocks and herds. Verse 8, "For he said, if Esau comes to the one company," oh, he's dividing them, "and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape." What a nice guy. So he's going to break up these groups and send maybe the handmaidens out in front of him with a few of the kids and have these two groups approaching Esau to both try to calm Esau down. And gosh, we don't want to lose everybody, so if these guys get wiped out, we'll just take off. And where are you going to go? Because you got Laban back in the other direction. So he's kind of stuck between a rock and the hard place, not realizing that he had the rock right with him. Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant, for with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. So when he left, he didn't have a whole lot to begin with. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered. Now, as he is saying these words, he ought to be looking around because God has already started that process with 11 sons, and he's going to have more, but he's just not getting it through his head what God has told him. But I do like the fact that he is stopping and he is turning to God at this particular point. And he's relying on God at this particular point. And you know, this is what we should be doing during this coronavirus situation. And you know, when people listen to this recording years from now, they're going to know exactly when it was given because of that mention of the coronavirus. And the vast majority of the people that are alive now in 10 years will be alive again, or not again, but still in 10 years. Simple prayers. Verse 13. So he's tired. He's been on the road for a while. And it says, so he spent the night there. And then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels. You ever had camel's milk?
No.
No. 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys. That's quite a haul that he's going to be sending to Esau. He delivered them into the hand of his servants. Every drove by itself and said to his servants, pass on before me and put a space between droves. So he's sending the front ones off to the slaughter, he thinks, is a possibility. He commanded the one in front, saying, when my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going and to whom do these animals in front of you belong? Then you shall say, these belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he is also behind us. Now, they're not saying, and behold, he's also coming. It's just, he's behind us. He's not there yet. Then he commanded also the second and the third and all those who followed the drove, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us, for he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. And then afterward, I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So you get the idea? I'm going to have one group come forward. They're going to present gifts. And then another group come forward, and they're going to present gifts. And this is an attempt to soften Esau's heart, or his brother Harry, as he was known. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent that night in the camp. Now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. So he's now sending them off, and look who's left behind. Jacob. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Now, this is kind of a fascinating story to me. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, this is Jacob not prevailing, this being, he touched the socket of his thigh so that the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. And it's not that this being could not defeat Jacob. He was trying to get Jacob just so exhausted that he would actually pay attention and listen. And Jacob still trying to operate in the flesh. And so this angelic being reached out and touched him in the thigh and crippled him to get him to stop. And you know something? That is something that the Lord sometimes, I think, does with us. That sometimes he has to cripple us in some way to get our attention. Or you'll see that when you look at the shepherds in ancient Israel, if they had a sheep or a lamb that kept running off, what would they do with it? They would break its leg. But they would then carry that lamb over their shoulder. If you've ever seen the last album that Keith Green put out, Songs for the Shepherd, he's got a lamb carrying over his shoulder. You Because sometimes the Lord will do that, because we get so stubborn and so stiff-necked and won't listen to him. Sometimes he will intervene and allow us to be in situations that will cause us to turn to him. But Jacob doesn't even give up completely then. Verse 26 says, then he said, let me go. Jacob would not let him go. And again, it's not Jacob defeating him. Jacob's just holding on to him in almost terror. Let me go, for the dawn is breaking. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. And I wish we had a recording of this, because the words he's saying, we don't have the inflection. But he's a broken man at this particular point, and he's just holding on to him. He wants to be blessed. So he said to him, what is your name? And he said, Jacob. And what does Jacob's name mean? Heel catcher. Supplanter. Remember, he was the one who was trying to pull Esau back into the womb when Esau was exiting first, his twin brother. He grabbed him, and the nurses there probably laughed and said, oh, look, he's a Jacob, a heel catcher, a supplanter. And so that had stuck with Jacob all these years, because he was a bit of a conniver at times. But that's all about to change. You shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God, with men, and have prevailed. What is Israel? It literally means governed by God. So from this point forward, Jacob is to be governed by God, not to be governed by his own flesh. And that's how he became the patriarch there of the 12 tribes. He was already their father. But he had a much deeper role that was going to come up a little bit later. So your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men, and have prevailed. And then Jacob asked him and said, please tell me your name. But he said, why is it that you ask my name? And he blessed him there. And so Jacob named the place Peniel. Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. So what does Peniel mean? The Hebrew word means the face of God. So Jacob believes he is seeing the face of God here. And if he is, and Scripture is correct that no man has seen the face of God and survived, who is he actually seeing? Jesus. So he had wrestled with Jesus. And he had no hope of defeating Jesus, by the way, but he wrestled with him, and Jesus got him turned around, totally and completely. Doesn't mean he's perfect yet. We'll see, he still has some character flaws, but his life will change dramatically. I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. And now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. And, we'll just continue on. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh and the sinew of the hip. I don't know why we need to know that information, but they would not eat that sinew of the hip, because if God had touched him there, they considered that holy. Not that they were eating humans, but they wouldn't do it on the cattle or the sheep or the camels or anything else. And this was not something assigned to them not to do by God. This was something that they did sort of as a sign of respect. But no proclamation, no command from God to do it at all. Let's continue on. So chapter 33. And then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him. Well, the number of men has not gone down. And so he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids. He put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next. Well, remember, Rachel was his favorite. And Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them. Oh, see, his attitude's changing. He's still going to go out in front, or finally going to go out in front. And he bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And what would happen is he would walk, and then he'd stop, and he'd bow, and he'd get up, and he'd walk again, and he would bow, and so on and so on until he approached his brother Esau. And this was a sign of submission. It's non-threatening. Verse 4, then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him. Did we expect that to happen? We don't know all that went on with Esau after Jacob left. We know that Esau became very, very wealthy because Jacob didn't really steal his inheritance. He got the right to be the firstborn and have the Messiah go through him, which was the most important thing. But Esau still got a great inheritance. And if he's got 400 guys with him, he's got a lot of power as well. So Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Surprise, surprise. And he lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, "Who are these with you?" So he said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." And I like that. Every child is a gift from who?
God.
From God, absolutely. Every single one. And so Jacob has that part right. And then the maids came near with their children, and they bowed down. Leah likewise also came near with her children, and they bowed down. And afterward, Joseph came near with Rachel, and they bowed down. All of them are in submission at this point. And he said, "What do you mean by all this company which I have met?" So Esau saying, you know, why did you send all these groups out over and over again? And he said, "To find favor in the sight of my Lord." But Esau said, "I have plenty, my brother. Let what you have be your own." So Esau's not taking all these gifts at this particular time. But Jacob doesn't like that idea. Jacob said, "No, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably." What do you think that means? I see your face as one sees the face of God. It's not real clear in the Hebrew what actually this means, other than, you know, I'm looking at you, you've got a glow about you, and I see that the Lord is with you as well, and you're not going to do me any harm. But we're not quite sure what that means. verse 11, "Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Thus he urged him, and he took it. And then Esau said, "Let us journey and go, and I will go before you." So Esau's going to go ahead of him, and he's going to head back to where he's going. But he said to him, "My Lord knows that the children are frail and that the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me. And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die." So he's using that as probably a very valid excuse because he's been going for a little while. You can't overdrive the herds because remember, while you might have some full-grown cattle, you're still going to have their babies and the other offspring. And he has his offspring who've been traveling for quite some time now, so this is probably valid. Verse 14, "Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, and according to the place of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir," meaning Esau's place. And Esau said, "Please let me leave you with some of the people who are with me." But he said, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So Esau was going to leave some guys with him to take care of him or to make sure that he gets to where he's going, which is supposed to be Esau's place. So he may not fully trust him yet. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Sukkoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. And therefore the place is named Sukkoth. Now that's an interesting name. What does Sukkoth mean? It means a tabernacle or booths. In fact, there is a festival that is mentioned in Leviticus chapter 23, the Feast of Tabernacles, this festival of booths. And I won't go into it a lot tonight, but it has some fantastic prophetic significance. The idea is this is a temporary dwelling place. There is a new Jerusalem that we're all going to live in later on. And they celebrate this festival every year, just around Yom Kippur, this Feast of Booths. If you go over to Israel around that time and could fly over it in a helicopter or a hot air balloon, you will see all these temporary dwellings on top of the roofs. And that's where the people will stay during this particular time. And it's one of the festivals that plays a big part in the book of Revelation. Anyway, verse 18. Now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem. This is a very important place, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Paddan Aram and camped before the city. And he bought the piece of land where he pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And there he erected an altar and called it Elohi Israel. Basically, he's going to end up in Bethel. But Shechem is extremely important. Let's see why. We'll go a little bit further. Now, Dinah, who was the daughter of Leah, remember, Jacob had at least one daughter, and he probably had 10 more, but Dinah is important to this particular story. She kind of changes the directions of things, not necessarily through her own fault, but something happens to her. So now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. Right? Ladies, you're in a new place. You want to meet all the gals around town. And she's been traveling with a bunch of guys, and so she wants to go out and see what's happening. You know, you want to check out the latest fashions, or whatever it is that the ladies happen to be doing there. And, of course, back in that time, it was extremely popular for them to exchange things like jewelry and perfumes. And so that's probably why she's checking out Shechem. But this leads to disaster. When Shechem, the son of Hamor, or Hamor, the Hivite, the prince of the land, saw her, he took her and lay with her by force. What does that mean?
He raped her.
He was deeply attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the girl and spoke tenderly to her, which a lot of rapists apparently do. This doesn't make sense to me. Maybe had he started this way and done things the proper way, it all would have worked out, but here we've got part of the story. He falls in love with her for some reason and speaks tenderly to her. And so Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young girl for a wife." And now Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter, but his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob kept silent until they came in. I don't think I could keep silent if somebody had raped my daughter. And I'm sure that's true of all the men in here as well. But Jacob may have been keeping silent because he was overwhelmed with the number of guys there at Shechem. And his sons were away. But he should have intervened. And things would have possibly turned out differently. But he didn't. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved. You're darn right. And they were very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel. Noticing that they're already calling it Israel now, even though that just happened. They'd done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. In other words, you're not to rape. And this guy raped her. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage. Intermarry with us, give your daughter to us, and take our daughters for yourselves." And this was also fairly common to do this type of exchange. And in fact, if you ever studied the history of the royal family in England, you'll see that they intermarried with people from Italy and Germany, and just for a long period of time, you would do that. It was like having a treaty, and you'd share the benefits of both groups. Or even more groups than that, and it led to problems later on. I mean, it brought us Prince Charles. Need I say more? Anyway, verse 10, "Thus you shall live with us, and the land shall be open before you. Live and trade in it, and acquire property in it." Very welcoming guys following the post-rape. Shechem also said to her father and to her brothers, "If I find favor in your sight, then I will give whatever you say to. Ask me ever so much bridal payment and gift," because remember, they often purchased the brides. There was a dowry for them, "and I will give according as you say to me. But give me the girl in marriage." But Jacob's sons answered Shechem And watch what happens here. And his father Hamor went to seek because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a disgrace to us. Remember, under Abram's covenant, they were to be circumcised. And that same would be true for a foreigner coming in to live in their midst. They had to, in this case, actually become Jewish, contrary to the Galatians' way. But back then, they had to become Jewish. They had to go through the circumcision. The laws didn't exist yet, but they had to keep this covenant. So verse 15. Only on this condition will we consent to you, if you will become like us, and that every male of you be circumcised. I detect a hint of surreptitiousness going on here. Do you think this is really what they want? I find what they did actually very clever, and I can understand the anger of Dinah's brothers, but what they do is considered deceitful in Scripture.
Oops, an axe slipped.
Verse 16. Then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters for ourselves, and we will live with you and become one people. The Israelites are not supposed to become one people with any other group, are they? Not at all. But if you will not listen to us to be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and go. And now their words seemed reasonable to Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. That word reasonable is peaceful. In other words, we're not going to war over this. It's peaceful. We'll be joined together. Verse 19, the young man did not delay to do the thing because he was delighted with Jacob's daughter. Now he was more respected than all the household of his father. So Hamor and his son Shechem came to the gate of the city and spoke to the men of the city, saying, these men are friendly with us, therefore let them live in the land and trade in it. For behold, the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters in marriage and give our daughters to them, only on one condition, this condition. Will the men consent to us to live with us, to become one people, that every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised? So I want you to imagine this entire village of Shechem. All the men have to get circumcised basically at the same time. Now, do you see a potential problem for these people with that? If you get circumcised at that age as an adult, well, anything past a baby, it hurts a baby, but the guy's going to be walking hobbled and bent over after that particular procedure. They don't have modern-day bris. They're using stone knives or things like that to do this procedure. Very, very painful, very, very debilitating for a period of time. And that, of course, is what is behind the whole plan of Jacob's sons here. Verse 23, will not their livestock and their property and all their animals be ours? Only let us consent to them and they will live with us. And all who went out of the gate of his city listened to Hamor and to his son Shechem, and every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of the city. Now it came about on the third day, there's that three again, when they were in pain, that two of Jacob's sons, you know, you got the initial pain, and then you've got the scabs and things that go along with it, not to be gross, but they're in a lot of pain. Swelling, bleeding. Now it came about on the third day when they were in pain that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took a sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male because they couldn't fight back because they were in such pain. And Levi, you know, he's the father of the eventual priesthood, and he's involved in this. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went forth. And Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. Now, do you see that they did anything wrong here?
Kind of overreacted. They took vengeance.
They took vengeance, but they took vengeance on a lot of innocent people. Not just the rapist. You know, I, for one, as a father, now I had all sons, but you mess with my sons, just like any parent. And if I had daughters, it might be doubly so. And I'm sure if I had a daughter, her brothers would protect her. But you don't go into Prescott Valley and kill every male just because one male did something wrong, right? So they were deceptive, and they were actually using Abraham's covenant in that deception. You know, they were going to be part of them and thus part of God's blessing, and of course they would have to turn and worship God. But these guys were deceitful, and they destroyed everybody, and in their lust, they killed off all the men, and what did they end up doing? Taking the women. It doesn't work right. Verse 28, they took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and they captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives, even all that was in their house. So they basically went in after killing them all. They robbed them too. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land. Among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and my men being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household." But they said, "Should he treat our sister as a harlot?" Now notice they don't say, "Should they treat our sister as a harlot?" They knew that there was one person involved in this. And even his father, who I think should have reacted a little bit differently, talking about the father of the rapist, he still came to them peacefully. But these guys went overboard. Simeon and Levi initially, and then the rest of the brothers. So they went in and pillaged this entire place and destroyed it. And I think we're going to end there instead of doing chapter 35. We got through, what, three?
Yeah.